Thank you everyone for joining again, the second class in Rabbi Dr. Marty Luxion's series on the after the Ten Commandments, the laws of the covenant code. And yeah, thank you, of course, for your engagement with it as well. And I guess I'll just leave it to you now.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to see you you all again, and I will share my screen and get right to work on today's session. Just give me a second here. Slideshow from the beginning. Okay. Last week, we finished, at the session last week, I talked about the fact that we would be going slowly, and I said that we would probably only do one verse last week, and in fact, I didn't quite finish everything that I wanted to say about that last, that first verse. We will go on today, but I just wanted to go back to where we left off last week. And after hearing an impassioned defense of the brilliant scholarship of Ibn Ezra, I'm worried that what I'm going to say now will trouble people who are big fans of Rashi, because what I'm saying about Rashi could be seen as criticism of Rashi. But anyways, I'll take my chances and just remind everybody about what we saw at the end of the session last week. We saw that Rashi offered two explanations about the first verse. Ela hamishpatim asher tasin lifneihem. These are the rules, the laws, the cases, however you want to translate mishpatim, which you shall put before them. And again, reading the two explanations in English, the first one is, which you shall put before them. God said to Moses, do not think of saying, I shall teach them a section of the Torah twice or three times until it will become fluent in their mouths verbatim, but I shall not take the trouble to make them understand the reason for each thing and its significance. Therefore, scripture says, which you shall put before them, like a table fully laid in front of a person with everything ready for eating. And then a second explanation that Rashi offers, which you shall put before them. Before them means before Jewish judges, but not before Gentile judges. Even if you know concerning a specific issue that they, the Gentile judges, would rule in the same way as Jewish law would, do not bring the case before their courts. For he who brings Israel's law cases before the heathens desecrates the name of God and pays honor to the name of the idol. And at the end of the session last week, we pointed out together, we did a little bit of work together, noticing all the differences between these two understandings. So the one understanding of Mishpatim in the first comment of Rashi here, he understands Mishpatim as being the rules, that you have to explain the rules to them in a way that they'll understand the ideas behind them. And then in the second explanation, Rashi uses the word Mishpatim to mean a legal case. Legal cases should be brought before some courts, but not before other courts. And then the question is, what does them mean? Them in the first explanation means the Israelites who are learning the laws of the Torah from Moshe. And in the second case, them means Jewish judges, as opposed to non-Jewish judges. And who is the you in each case? According to the first comment of Rashi, you means you, Moshe, shall put these laws before the Israelites. While in the second explanation, you means any Jew who has a legal dispute and is considering taking it to a court of law, you should take it to a Jewish court. So we have, okay, just this, three big differences between. So how can Rashi offer two different explanations of the text that are syntactically, from a syntax point of view, they are mutually exclusive. They don't make, they can't go along with each other. Either the verse is addressed to Moshe or it's addressed to the individual Jew. Either them means Jewish judges or it means Jewish students. And either mishpatim means rules or it means legal cases. How can you offer two explanations here that don't go along with each other? A common principle, Professor Avraham Grossman of the Hebrew University, who's one of the experts on Rashi, has written in an article, Hayusha sabru shekasher matza Rashi chulsha b'chol echad mishnei haperushim he'edif lahavi et shnehem. There are those who have claimed that when Rashi sensed that each of two interpretations of a specific text involved some difficulty, he offered both of them. So that's the way some of the traditionalists who like to read Rashi's commentary try to solve the case. That the basic principle is whenever Rashi brings two explanations, it's because he sees some difficulty in each one of them. And that's what I was taught when I was a student, that is the way in which you should relate double explanations in Rashi. Grossman says that this approach was first championed by Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi back in the 15th century, and later it was popularized by Nechama Leibowitz, with whom I had the great privilege of studying, I guess, 50 years ago, and for a number of years after that, but I started studying with her about 50 years ago. And despite the fact that Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi and the Chava Leibovitch promulgated this principle about Rashi, as Grossman writes here, Kol Misha Ha'emet Ner L'Raglav, any truth seeker who wants to avoid dubious explanations will have to admit that we do not have a sufficient explanation for all the many instances of double comments in Rashi's commentary. Apparently, at least in some of the cases, it is simply love of Midrash that motivated Rashi not to make do with one explanation. Why does Rashi offer these two explanations? Because he likes the two ideas. He likes the idea that a teacher should explain well so that people understand the ideas behind it and they don't just understand the rules. And he also likes the idea that Jews should take their legal disputes before a Jewish court and not before a Gentile court. And so if that involves reading the text in two mutually exclusive ways, Rashi feels quite comfortable doing that. I didn't bother translating this text into English. I'll try to translate it a little bit as I go along, but I just want you to see the way in which people stood on their head to try to get the two explanations of Rashi to make sense. Why did Rashi feel that he had to offer two explanations? So this is the super commentary on Rashi. Many of you will know that there are quite a number, dozens and perhaps hundreds of super commentaries on Rashi. And a brilliant book about it was recently written by Eric Lowy, who used to be a professor at York University and now is a professor at Bar-Ilan University, about the super commentaries. One of the most famous super commentaries was the commentary written by the Maharal in the 16th century. And so he tries to explain how Rashi ended up coming up with these two explanations. Lifnehem, below Lifnei Goyim. Because it says lifnehem in front of them, because that hem shows up at the end of the word lifnehem, the kinui with a pronoun at the end, the mashma otam shuzkeru lemala, the hem Yisrael, alze kai lifnehem. So who's the hem has to be somebody who's been mentioned beforehand. So that must be Jewish judges, although Jewish judges weren't mentioned beforehand. Anyways, okay, we'll accept that point. And even though before Rashi tried to get that word lifnehem to mean that you should teach well, it's like a set table, like you're explaining things, a student could just come and sit down and understand everything because you've placed it before them in an organized manner. Lo darshinan rak lifne dichtiv. Asher tasim lifanim. So that first explanation was based on the first four letters of the word lifnehem, lamed, pe, nun, yud. And because it wasn't necessary, this is the theory, that Rashi will offer an explanation only, a second explanation, only if he's not satisfied with the first one. Well, what was unsatisfactory about the first one? The first one doesn't explain why the Hey-Mem is at the end of the word Lifnehem. Why doesn't the text just say, Ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifanim? Not to mention the obvious for any speaker of Hebrew, that makes no sense to say asher tasim lefanim. The word lefanim in biblical Hebrew, if it has any meaning to it, it means back in the old days, v'zot lefanim b'Yisrael, back in the old days, this is what was done. But about kinui lifnehem lo darshinan, the first explanation didn't explain the hey mem at the way, and the im lo barach lo moshi, k'shulchan aruch lifnei adam, havi lemichtav asher tasim lefanim. If the first explanation was all that the text was trying to speech to teach, then the text would have said, these are the mishpatim asher tasim lefanim, my lifnehem, why is there a hey mem there? It came to teach us the second derasha. So Gur Aryeh wedded to the approach to Rashi, that what Rashi is doing all the time is actually careful biblical exegesis, and he's looking at the text, careful commentary, and he's saying, have I explained every letter of the words? And why is he offering two contradictory explanations here? Because he has trouble with an ostensible, unnecessary hey and mem at the end of this, at the end of the word lifnehem. So today, I mentioned the scholarship of Dr. Yedida Eisenstadt, and now today I'm mentioning the scholarship of Professor Avram Grossman and many other people who write about Rashi, who now suggest that the reasonable way of reading Rashi is someone who is collecting Midrashim, who is anthologizing Midrashim, who is a teacher, who, like any good teacher, is trying to think of, what do I want my students to come away from this class? What idea do I want them to come away from this class with? And he wants them to come away with the idea that they should, that a teacher should teach well so that everybody understands, and that a litigant should bring a court case to a Jewish court. Okay, finally, we now get to verses 2 and following, and we get to some very troubling texts. The beginning of Parshat Mishpatim deals with rules of the Eved Ivri, a Hebrew slave. Some translations prefer to write a Hebrew servant. If you insist, you could say servant. But I think that in the same way that we say that mi beit avadim means the house of slavery, and when we say avadim hayinu lefaro lemitzrayim, that we were avadim to Pharaoh in Egypt, we mean slaves. And so consistency kind of suggests that we should translate, when you acquire a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years. In the seventh year, he shall go free without payment. If he came single, he shall leave single. If he had a wife, his wife shall leave with him. If his master gave him a wife and she has borne him children, the wife and her children shall belong to the master, and he shall leave alone. We'll begin by talking about the first verse here, but we will, towards the end of today's session, also get to the second and third verses here about the wife, which presents a a different problem than the general problem here of the slavery that is reflected here in this text. My teacher, Professor Nahum Sarna, in his commentary in the book of Exodus, writes about slavery in Israel and the ancient Near East. All the law collections of the ancient Near East deal with the topic of slavery. This evil institution, this is Professor Sarna with a value judgment that I think we all would agree with now in 2022, just to emphasize the Professor Sarna that I'm referring to now is Professor Nahum Sarna, Zichrono Livracha, blessed memory. His son, Professor Jonathan Sarna, has also written quite a bit about slavery. Professor Jonathan Sarna might be the leading historian of American Jewry alive today. And the, as we'll see in the continuation of this session, the question of Jews and slavery is not just a question in biblical studies, but it's also a question in the early history of the United States. And who knows, I'm not such a big expert in Canada, but perhaps in the early history of Canadian Jewry also. This evil institution was widespread, persistent, and socially sanctioned, Professor Nahum Sarna writes. Biblical legislation is directed against toward enhancing the social and legal status of this human chattel. This humanitarian approach expresses itself in a variety of ways. The slave is termed your brother. So a Hebrew slave is referred to as your brother in Leviticus and Vayikra. A slave possesses an inalienable right to rest on the Sabbath day and on festivals. The Torah makes that clear. He is to be avenged if he dies from a beating from his master. We'll see that in the continuation here of Parshat Mishpatim, that there is, it says that if a master kills his slave, he shall surely be avenged. On the pshat level, the word avenged is not defined, but the rabbis later said that avenged means capital punishment, just like any other case of murder in Jewish law. The owner who kills a slave of his shall be subject to the death penalty for killing his slave. So Professor Sarna, you know, hasn't solved the problem that we all have when we look at this text, but he is pointing out that the Torah has taken various steps past what was accepted in the ancient world. In the ancient world, the slave was not considered to be your brother. The slave was not given days off from work. He worked every day of the week. And in the ancient world, as we will see right now in the Encyclopedia Britannica article about master-slave relationships, I took this because it's the sweep of history and geography is found here in the Encyclopedia Britannica. An owner could kill his slave with impunity in Homeric Greece, in ancient India, in the Roman Republic, in Islamic countries, and in Anglo-Saxon England, in medieval Russia, and many parts of the American South before 1830. So the idea of holding a slave owner responsible for killing a slave whom he owns was not part of the standard legal system, and the Torah is providing more protection for the slave than slaves received in many countries and in many eras of history. The Code of Justinian in the 6th century of the Common Era changed the definition of the slave from a thing to a person and prescribed the death penalty for an owner who killed a slave by torture, poison, or fire. So it seems like the Code of Justinian is saying, while it is okay to kill your slave, you're not allowed to kill your slave in some in some terribly cruel manner. If you're going to kill your slave, do it quickly, but not through torture, poison, or fire. In Spain, the laws of 1260s and 1270s denied owners the right to kill their slaves. But as it said in the previous paragraph here, in the American South before 1830, in a number of states in the American South, there was no recourse if a slave was killed. I don't know whether this makes people feel better. It makes me feel a little better that while the Torah is not promulgating the kind of values that we value today in 2022, it was quite a bit of a revolution against the values of the ancient world. If there, some of you were reading the Wall Street Journal last week, I apologize for having you read again an article. I just happened, as I was preparing the class, I was reading the Wall Street Journal just last week. And I'm sure a lot of you know that in the United States right now, there are many places that are doing cheshbon ha-nefesh, are looking back to see what relationship our state or our company or our university had with slavery in the previous centuries in the United States. And Harvard put together a study, Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery. Harvard University decided that it should look into its relationship with slavery. And this guy named Ira Stahl, writing in the Wall Street Journal, wrote, "The first Jew at Harvard was a slaveholder." That's the bombshell, so far as I can tell, buried in the appendix of the new report, Harvard and the Legacy of Slavery, released by the university this week. The report's list of human beings enslaved by prominent Harvard affiliates. So that's, you can find a list of faculty members and administration people in the 18th century and beyond at Harvard who owned other human beings, includes the enslaved persons Cuffy and Cicely, owned by Judah Monus. Monus lived from 1683 to 1764 and was an instructor in Hebrew at Harvard College from 1722 to 1760. In researching this article, as Ira Stahl writes, I discovered a third possible slave, my Negro child Moria, mentioned in Monus's 1760 will. So it's possible that this Monus, who taught Hebrew at Harvard in the 18th century, had three slaves. Stahl continues, I first encountered Monus's name more than a decade ago while working on a biography of the American revolutionary leader Samuel Adams. Part of the required curriculum for Harvard students from 1735 to 1755 was the study of Hebrew grammar from a textbook written by Monus. So first of all, the idea that everybody who went to Harvard in the middle of the 18th century had to study Hebrew grammar, that's, it's a good feeling. And the textbook was written by this guy, Monus. That might seem like an obscure detail, but it's of historical significance because Harvard students in that era included Samuel Adams, his cousin and the future president, John Adams, and their fellow signers of the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, Robert Treat Paine, and William Ellerly. Those of you who are Americans here might recognize these names more than we Canadians recognize. Some of these names we recognize, some of them, but perhaps not all of them. So a lot of people were exposed to Monus' teaching of Hebrew grammar at Harvard. Monus had converted to Christianity from Judaism 1 month before joining the Harvard faculty. In a 2018 article for the Harvard Divinity Bulletin, John D. Levinson, who is a professor of Jewish studies at Harvard today, who is an observant Jew and not somebody who converted to Christianity. Thank God in the 21st century, it's possible to teach at Harvard without converting to Christianity. But in the 18th century, if you wanted to teach at Harvard, you were it was expected that you would be a Christian. So John D. Levinson writes that the conversion had been a condition of hiring. If he wanted the job, he was told that he would have to convert to Christianity. The baptism took place in Harvard Yard. Amazing that they baptized the incoming professor of Hebrew in Harvard Yard. And Professor Levinson writes, although doubts about Monas's sincerity in converting have long been raised, I am certain that he was absolutely sincere in his desire for a Harvard professorship. So perhaps he wasn't sincere in his desire to become a Christian, but he was very sincere in his desire for a Harvard professorship. At the end of the 19th century, there was another famous Jew who converted to Christianity and then became a professor of Hebrew at St. Petersburg University. And his name was Daniel Chvolson. And Chvolson was once asked whether he converted to Christianity out of conviction. He said, yes, it was out of conviction. I was convinced that it was better to be a professor of Hebrew at St. Petersburg than to be a Melamed in Minsk or Pinsk. So that's what was going on in those days. However, back to slavery and the slaves that Monas owned. And, you know, people talk about this all the time when they're talking about the United States, about the founding of the United States, about the contradiction, about the hypocrisy involved in the rhetoric that one finds of the founders of the United States. Samuel Adams described the British as taskmasters and likened the American revolutionaries to the children of Israel fleeing slavery in Egypt. In a speech to the Continental Congress in 1777, Samuel Adams noted that they had told the world of their determination, quote, to die free men rather than to live as slaves. That's why the American Revolution took place, in order to die as free men and not to live as slaves. The Declaration of Independence spoke of how all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with the right to liberty. And the people who were writing this were slave owners, and they continued to own slaves. So the author of this article in the journal writes, it's one thing to reckon with hypocrisies in the stories of plantation owning Virginians like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, who owned slaves and talked the good talk about freedom. That's old news. But Samuel Adams's Harvard Hebrew professor, that hits closer to home for those who consider Boston to be the cradle of liberty. What's with this professor, this Jewish professor? Of course, he converted to Christianity. But what's with this professor who is teaching about the values of the Hebrew Bible and is owning slaves? If the future American revolutionaries were diligent students of the Hebrew that Monas taught, they would have been able to parse with some care the text of Exodus. At Sinai, after God identifies himself as having brought you out of Egypt, the house of slavery, he issues the commandment that the children of Israel obey the Sabbath in part by not having their own slaves work on the seventh day. So the Ten Commandments begins with a great declaration of how God took the Israelites out of slavery. And then the assumption, when we get to the fourth commandment, when we get to the commandment of the Sabbath, the assumption is that these Israelites have slaves who are working for them and are told that they have to give a day off to their slaves on the seventh day. In experiencing the irreconcilable contradiction between the reality of slave ownership and the ideal of freedom, in other words, the American revolutionaries weren't unlike the children of Israel. They were following in their footsteps. So in the same way, you can put it either way. You could say in the same way that the Israelites had this kind of hypocrisy about talking the good talk about freedom, but owning slaves, the same thing was happening in the 18th century in America. Or you could say, just as it happened in the 18th century in America, it was also happening back in biblical times. The people were talking about freedom and continuing to own slaves. A troubling Talmudic text on this uh, on this subject can be found in the Gemara, Psachim, related to Pesach. I had the pleasure of hearing a shiur from my daughter, Chana Lakshenbaum, who some of you might know, was teaching about this text among others, talking about in a section of the text that talks about Manishtana. Rav Nachman asked his slave Daru, if a master frees a slave and gives him gold and silver, what should that slave say to the master? Daru answered, he should thank and praise the master. Rav Nachman answered, you have exempted us from saying Manishtana. And he began the Seder with Avadim Hayinu. In other words, Rav Nachman is suggesting the whole purpose of Manishtana is to just get a conversation going about slavery and freedom. And once you get that conversation going, then you can tell the story. And if you've got the conversation going, the Gemara talks about a number of things that can be done instead of Manishtana. But as my daughter pointed out when she taught this text in the shiur that I heard recently, this is a very troubling text, as it sounds like Rav Nachman is turning to his slave. And if you were Rav Nachman's slave, Daru, and your owner said to you, what would a slave do if his master frees a slave and gives the slave gold and silver? Then Daru might think, oh, I'm going to get freed. This is the holiday of freedom. It's Pesach. And that doesn't happen here. I see that somebody has raised a hand with a question. We're going to keep the questions for the end. I'm sorry. But hold on to that question. Keep it in mind, and we'll get to the questions in the last 10 minutes. My daughter Chana pointed out in her shiur that there is at least one Rishon, one early commentator on the Talmud who says, oh, Rav Nachman must have freed this slave after talking to him like this. But on a certain level, I think that often when you read Talmudic texts about people celebrating freedom on Pesach, you get the impression that what they were celebrating was the fact that we aren't slaves anymore, but not that there isn't any slavery anymore. And that today we are more comfortable with celebrating the idea of Pesach is the holiday of trying to get rid of slavery, of the holiday of freedom, the holiday where we get across the idea that all human beings were created in the image of God. But it isn't clear that in the Torah or in the Gemara we have that principle. We have, as I said before, and as Professor Nahum Sarna said before, we have the Torah considerably improving the lot of the slave, but not eradicating slavery. Okay. So why did they begin with the laws of a Hebrew slave? So Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, at the end of the 12th century, a younger contemporary of Rashbam, might have been a student of Rashbam, says a Hebrew slave, since the text says, God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage, for you to be free people, the text now proceeds to explain that they cannot be sold into permanent slavery. Okay, slavery has not been eradicated, but permanent slavery has been eradicated. An Israelite will never become a permanent slave anymore. That's what the Torah is saying. Since I, God, do not want them to be slaves anymore, since they are my slaves, as it is written, for it is to me that the Israelites are slaves. They are my slaves whom I freed from the land of Egypt. My deed is older than others. God is saying, I have a deed of ownership of the Israelites. I freed them from Egypt. I own them. Li b'nei Israel abadim, they are my slaves. And because of that, they can't be somebody else's slaves. And so, according to Bechor Shor, the text here is simply a continuation of the first commandment, the first paragraph of the Decalogue, which was a promotion of freedom. And even if we haven't reached the level of the understanding of freedom that we would expect now in the 21st century. We have reached a higher level than before, as Professor Sarna argued before. And then Mahorshor makes an interesting comment. He says that a slave goes free in the seventh year. In the seventh year, he shall go free, as there is no plowing, sowing, or harvesting. So work of a slave isn't crucial. Why, for those of you who don't know, anybody who's living here in Israel certainly knows that this year right now is a Shemitah year. It's the sabbatical year. You walk into the supermarket and you can find a half a dozen different kinds of hechsherim, of kosher certifications, depending on how you feel the rules of the sabbatical year should be observed. But in the traditional understanding of a sabbatical year was a year when there was no plowing, no sowing, or harvesting. And Behor Shor comes up with a fascinating suggestion that the slave goes free in the seventh year because you don't actually need the work of the slave that much in the seventh year. I'll get back to that comment in a second, but Behor Shor liked that explanation a lot, and he gave a very similar explanation to that in his commentary to Deuteronomy. In the commentary, in the text of Deuteronomy, it says that in the sabbatical year also, there is a remission of debts. This shall be the nature of the remission. Every creditor shall remit the due that he claims from his fellow. He shall not dun his fellow. I assume that not everybody, but maybe many or most of you will know that to dun means to ask for the repayment of a loan. So the Torah says that in the seventh year, particularly at the end of the sabbatical year, according to the halachic understanding, debts are forgiven and you are no longer allowed to ask for repayment of a debt that is due to you. You shall not dun your fellow. You may dun the foreigner. However, if a non-Jew owes you money, you are allowed to ask for repayment. This was always a troubling passage. Christians criticized Jews for having this kind of negative attitude towards non-Jews. But Behor Shor makes an interesting comment here based on the same principle. You may dun the foreigner who continues to sow and to harvest. Accordingly, the foreigner, the non-Jew, can repay you the debt. But your fellow Jew who doesn't plow or sow or harvest, how can he repay? It should be remembered that generally in the ancient world, people who borrowed money to get from one harvest to the next harvest. I remember my father, Zichron Oli Bracha, taught me something that surprised me when I was a child. He taught me that the people who borrow money these days are almost always wealthy people. And when you walk into a bank and you are poor and you wish to borrow money from the bank, it is very difficult for you to get a loan. But if you are wealthy and you walk into the bank and you want to borrow a large amount of money in order to start a new business, you are much more likely to get a positive answer from the bank. But in the ancient world, and probably before city dwelling became so important in society, most loans were for the sake of getting to the next harvest. I need time until I can harvest that next harvest in an agrarian society. And in the sabbatical year, Behor Shor points out quite logically, the Jewish farmer is going to have difficulty repaying the debt because he doesn't have crops coming in. However, the non-Jewish farmer is going to be able to repay the debt. And so that's how he explains this rule. I am wondering if anybody can see a problem between, in the first comment that Bechor Shor made on this page. If anybody does, then you want to write something in the chat about a problem in the, this is a very creative suggestion that Bechor Shor makes here, that the slave goes free in the seventh year, because in the seventh year, his services are not required so much, because there's not so much work going on in the seventh year, because it's the Shemitah year, because it's the sabbatical year. Yes, and Ruth writes here, the seventh year may not be referring to the Shemitah cycle. Ellie writes, the seventh year of the slavery may not be the Shemitah year. In fact, according to every other Jewish author who's ever written about the subject, the seventh year does not mean that. It's written in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the seventh year from when he was sold as a slave, not the seventh year that the world observes. Rashbam, who is generally dedicated to Pshat, here also says that the Talmudic understanding is the correct understanding of the seventh year from the time that he was sold as a slave, not the seventh year of the sabbatical cycle. And Bechor Shor is off by himself in a universe of suggesting that actually this law is a reference to the sabbatical year. Another commentator who addressed the reason that the laws begin here with the laws of slaves, the first of this is Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, moved from Christian Spain here to Israel in the last years of his life. The first law is that of a Hebrew slave, because releasing a slave in the seventh year contains a remembrance of the departure from Egypt. Why do they start with this? Because the whole thing comes from Yetziat Mitzrayim, and so this is the form of Yetziat Mitzrayim, of the exodus from Egypt, that we still observe of releasing our slaves, which is mentioned in the first commandment, as it is written, bear in mind that you were slaves in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you, therefore I enjoin this commandment upon you today. After the book of Deuteronomy says, free your slaves and give them gifts when you free them, it says, this is remembering the exodus from Egypt. It also contains a remembrance of creation, just like the Sabbath, for the seventh year serves for a slave as a complete rest from the work of his master, just as the seventh day of the week does. So the laws of the slave kind of replicate in certain ways the first of the commandments and the commandments about the Shabbat. But now we'll try to quickly deal with the big issue that shows up in this text, aside from the whole issue of why Jews continue to have Jewish slaves, to have slaves at all, if you wish. What does the text here say about the Hebrew slave's family? If he came single, he shall leave single. If he had a wife, his wife shall leave with him. Yatze'a ishto imo. If his master gave him a wife and she had borne him children, the wife and her children shall belong to the master and he shall leave alone. Rashi writes, Vim bal isha yisraelitu, if he had an Israelite wife, his wife shall leave. So we're talking about a Jew who's married to a Jewish woman and he becomes a slave. Why? In the rabbinic understanding, when does somebody become a slave? Either that he stole and he cannot repay the theft, or he's destitute, and the only way that he can support himself is by selling himself as a slave. And then when he goes free, he'll have the money that he got for selling himself as a slave. But Rashi notices that it says here that if he had a wife, his wife shall leave with him. That seems to imply that she also was a slave. And Rashi says, Nihich nisasha titse. Who brought her into slavery that the text must state that she goes free? What business is this? If he committed theft and he became a slave in order to pay off his debt, why is his wife a slave. Rather, by saying this, Rashi says, scripture teaches us that he who acquires a Hebrew servant is obligated to provide food for his wife and children too. According to Rashi's understanding, no, it's not possible that his wife actually became a slave when he became a slave. It must be that it's saying that the responsibility that I, the owner of this Hebrew slave, of course, have to feed my Hebrew slave, but I also have to, according to Rashi's understanding, feed his wife, who wasn't doing any work for me. Shadal, Rabbi Samuel David Luzzatto, writing in the 19th century, taught at the Modern Orthodox Seminary in Padua, lived from 1800 to 1865. Shadal says, I think a good explanation of the historical development of what's going on here. According to the plain meaning, Lafia Pshat, his wife comes with him into the master's house and serves with him. That if the man becomes a slave, the Pshat is suggesting that his wife also becomes a slave. However, Rashi and some of the rabbis said, who brought her in that she should go forth? Rather, scripture teaches that one who acquires a Hebrew servant is obligated to support his wife and children. Rashi is almost always the case that has not made up this answer. He's quoting from standard rabbinic sources, the Mechilta and the Babylonian Talmud. But Shadal tries to reconstruct history. He writes, this rule was designed to increase the quality of mercy and compassion among Israel. The rabbis did not allow the wife to be forced to enter into the master's house, but they obligated the master to provide for her and her children. She was to live in her own house. This might be just a little difficult to accept that this is precisely what they had in mind, but this is how Shadal's trying to reconstruct the history here. This destitute man still has a house where his wife can live. Okay, maybe she's living with relatives or something like this. She was to live in her own house, and she, not the master, was entitled to the proceeds of her work. So ruled Maimonides. So rabbinic literature says, she doesn't become, Shadal says, the pshat suggests here that she does become a slave, but rabbinic literature teaches that she doesn't become a slave. And this was, laharbot midat ha-chesed v'rachamim b'Yisrael. The rabbis did this in order to increase the quality of mercy and compassion among Israelites. However, Shadal continues, just as the Torah permitted a father to sell his minor daughter, we'll see that text a little bit next week, it appears that it also permitted him to sell himself along with his wife and minor children. It is well known that in ancient times, the father ruled over his household and held their lives in his hands. The Torah took this authority away from him and allowed a rebellious son to be put to death only by the decision of a court. The ben sorerum moreh might appear to us to be a very radical suggestion that a ben sorerum moreh can be put, the rebellious son can be put to death by a Jewish court. But actually, it is likely, and Shadal was saying, and I agree with him, it is likely that the surprising nature of this law was that it was saying that a father was not allowed to kill the rebellious son on his own, that only a court could make a decision like this. Similarly, a man's sale of his wife and children was permitted by the written Torah, but forbidden by the oral Torah. So Shadal is suggesting that there is this process, what Professor Tamar Ross has called the continuous revelation, the revelation that takes place in various stages, that, you know, there's a world where slaves are have absolutely no rights, and then the written Torah comes along and gives some basic rights to slaves, and they go free at the end of the seventh year, and they don't work on Shabbat, and they can't be killed, and then rabbinic literature comes along and makes it more from our perspective, more moral, more rights for various slaves. In the 19th century, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman did not like an approach like this. He points out, in the Book of Kings, the widow complains to Elisha that the creditor was coming to take her two sons as slaves since she could not repay her debt. And in Nehemiah, many complained that their children, sons and daughters had been taken as slaves because of the parents' debts. Clearly, the story told, according to Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman in Germany in the beginning of the 19th century, clearly the stories told in Kings and in Nehemiah are infractions of Torah laws. But that is the question, how clearly that is the case. If we're talking about the fact that a man can sell his daughter as a slave, when we're talking about the fact that a man who becomes a slave, his wife becomes a slave, Professor Nachum Sarna again writes here, there are scriptural indications that in practice, defaulting members or defaulting debtors or members of their family would be subject to seizure by a creditor and forced into service. Whereas the prophets denounced this practice, Mesopotamian laws actually provide for the seizure of debtors and for the seizure of the family of debtors. So Professor Sarna is very careful in how he phrases this. He says that at least in practice, what was the Torah actually saying? So Chantal has this radical and interesting theory that the Torah is the beginning of a more liberal approach, and that when rabbinic literature comes along, it provides a more liberal understanding of the rights of slaves and restrictions on the actions of owners. Okay, we'll stop here, and I can look at the chat, and also anybody who wishes to unmute himself or herself and ask a question, whoever raised a hand along the way and couldn't get their question in, could ask now, please go ahead. Okay. Yes, so are we slaves of God or servants of God? Someone asks. Rabbi. Yes. Would Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz have said that slavery is a biblically mandated value or a biblically tolerated value? I'm sure that Rabbi Berkowitz would have said that it is a biblically tolerated value and not a biblically mandated value. Yes. The idea that Marty Crossell asks, doesn't the idea that the Torah has 70 faces implicitly leave intellectual space for one commentator having contradictory interpretations of a single verse? Maybe. I like that idea, Marty, and I would suggest that that could be the key for understanding the fact that Rashbam does this kind of dance between the rabbinic understanding of a text and the pshat understanding that he offers, and they are often contradictory. Yes, Judah Amon is converted to Christianity to teach at Harvard. Harvard was stole for clergy in the early days, just as like the University of Toronto was in the early days a religious institution. Rana has a hand up there. You want to
I think you cleared it up. How does one become a slave, and why does one become a slave? I guess there weren't any prisons in those days.
That's right.
Yes. And so
yes, it was a very different kind of system. So if you committed grand larceny or something like this and couldn't pay back the debt, then you went to work for the mm-hmm. person from whom you stole, and you only went to work for a maximum of 6 years. That was the innovation here. Mm-hmm. You could not become a slave for mm-hmm. life. Okay, so Sam asks, shouldn't we differentiate between a slave and a servant? I'm not sure. It strikes me that there is no distinction in biblical Hebrew, and I agree with you, there is no distinction. Yes. Okay. The seventh year, another divine innovation of laws of slavery. Wife and kids are not left out in the cold, and she could do useful housework while her husband works in the field. So, you know, other commentators, that was Ruth suggesting that, other commentators say that this is actually something that is for the benefit of the family of the person who had to become a slave. Perhaps the rabbis is but as Shadal quoted Rambam, she gets the benefits from the owner. The owner has to feed her, but she gets to work and to keep the money that she earns. Perhaps the rabbis began to see that women should not be property to be seized. I hope that you're right about that, Deborah. You're welcome, Chaim. Is the translation done, your translation? No, it's in JPS. When do you think neologisms can enter translation? Done is a really old word, actually, as far as I know. I'll just tell you a little story. One time I was on sabbatical here in Israel when I was still living in Toronto, and I came home, and the person who had been living in my house had some kind of debt of $7.12 to some company that hadn't been paid. And I got a letter threatening legal action against me if I didn't pay this tiny amount of money. And I phoned up and I said to the company that sent the letter, I said, I received a dunning letter from you. And the person at the other end said, oh, I haven't heard the word dunning for a long time. That's what that person's job was. It was to dun, to try to collect debts. But it's a very old word. Okay.
Rabbi, is it possible that the rabbis just saw that it was impossible that the man should be separated from his wife, even if he was going into slavery?
That it's very possible. Yes. That they wanted to keep the couple together. You know, it can be understood as being for the benefit of the family, that the family is kept together. You know, it's so hard for us to get our mind around this institution, which, you know, like, thank God it's not an institution that we have any experience with, but it is possible to understand it in that way. Anyone want to ask a last question? I want to get off soon and get to Yom HaTzma'ut davening, which is starting very soon here. Like cities of refuge for manslaughter, prisons make a person a better criminal. Okay, maybe prisons actually do improve human beings. I think there's a lot of doubt about that these days.
I wonder whether the Gamet Hagoy, Dan Anochi, implies that the Brit Ben Absarim promises reparations.
That it is the simplest reading of that text, Gershon, when you go free, achareichem yetzu berchush gadol. Yes,
that would explain the borrowing of the kelim and the garments, wouldn't it? It's fulfillment of Dan Anofi.
Yes, that's right, for sure. And Asher writes here, even until pretty recent times, if you've not owned land, how are you supposed to make a living? It's really a great question. Isn't there a very fine line between slavery on the one hand and serfdom or apprenticeship on the other? Yes, Asher, I agree with you. And there are those who have said that what the rabbis did was they turned the institution of the Eved Ivri from being a slave into being a serf. Being a serf is no holiday either, as we know from our study of history. But I guess if we had the choice between being a serf and being a slave, we would probably opt for being a serf. But right now, I am going to run off to shul and celebrate the freedom of Israel. And I hope that you all have a Chag Sameach, and we'll see you next week. And we will continue with slavery next week, and I hope that we'll go beyond slavery next week. All the best to you. Chag Sameach.
Thank you. Chag Sameach. And to everyone, again, thank you for coming. We're starting a lot of new classes at Torah in Motion these days. So, you know, please check them out. I'd be really happy to see you there. And as always, please invite friends. And looking forward to seeing you next week or before then. Thank you.